Blog Talk Radio.
Exposing the lies.
The lies.
Shattering the consensus. Highlighting the hypocrisy. Global Cooling Radio with Mark Gillar.
Welcome to Global Cooling Radio. This is Mark Gillar, and our special guest today is Bruno Wiskel. He is the author of The Sky Is Not Falling, Putting Climate Change on Trial. Bruno, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm Mark, and thanks for having me on today.
Oh, absolutely, and I think it's very fitting that the subtitle of the book is Putting Climate Change on Trial. Because if you talk to other skeptics like Joanne Nova and Lord Monckton, my show is kind of like jury duty for well-known skeptics. Everybody's number comes up every once in a while, and you've got to be on the show. In fact, that reminds me, I have to send another notice out to Lord Monckton. I have to say I enjoyed The Sky Is Not Falling immensely. You have an approach, and I've read a gazillion books on climate change, but you have an approach that is very straightforward, very easy for the layperson to understand, and certainly one that I think could even convey the message to school children and maybe if you dumb it down a little bit more, some of the administrators who make the decisions at schools. And it's just a fantastic book, so congratulations on getting that out.
Well, yeah, Mark, one of the things that I had on The Sky Is Not Falling is, as you well know, is this is one of the books that actually has a movie in the book, and I'm not talking about a CD. I'm talking about an actual movie within the pages of the book that shows the last 18,000 years of deglaciation. Now, what's cool about that is that you can watch the ice move back for at least 13,000 years of the Earth's history. And what it does, what I'm trying to prove with that little movie, and all the movie is a bunch of still photos. So when you fan the pages of the book, as everybody knows, it was done stick figure movies, is that what it does is it shows the ice receding. But what the primary purpose of that is meant to show is that for the last 18,000 years, the ice has been melting, the sea level has been rising, and out of that 18,000 years, for 99.5% of it, it has all occurred without the help of human-produced carbon dioxide. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that because this is a continual process within the Earth, it's really unlikely that we're causing, that human-induced carbon dioxide is causing the global warming right now.
So let me make sure I understand this by way of a review. You're telling me and the listeners that climate actually changed before man started flying around in airplanes and driving around in SUVs?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Mark, if I was to tell you it's going to be hotter this afternoon than it was this morning, you'd believe me. You have no problem with that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, because you've seen it before. You've gone through this. You said, yeah, yesterday it was warm in the afternoon, cooler in the morning, the day before, same thing, day before. And if I was to tell you that it's going to be colder in January than it isn't going to be in July, you'd have no problem agreeing with me. Is that correct?
Based on my personal history, I would have to say you were correct.
Absolutely. And so here's what the situation is that most people only understand what has happened in the context of their own lives. So if I was to tell you that it's warm in the afternoon and warmer in July, you would believe me. But the trouble that I have as a geologist is trying to show people that there are larger cycles than just the daily and yearly cycles, right? This glaciation, deglaciation happens over the period of tens of thousands of years. And so my job as a geologist is to show people exactly how these changes occur over such a long period of time. Now, one of the things that we talk about, I talk about the last deglaciation that started, the ice the ice reaches glacial maximum. And when I'm talking about glacial maximum, everybody thinks Canada is a cold place. And let me tell you, it is. But what some people don't know is that the glaciers reached all the way to New York City. And in fact, had the glaciers not, you know, gone that far, places like Long Island wouldn't exist. They would be below sea level. Entire Long Island is all glacial till, which means it was at the end of the glacier. So when Al Gore shows his movie, you know, of New York flooding, what he didn't show is that many years ago that New York was the same place that was flooded actually was under ice. New York City, 18,000 years ago, was actually not on the coast. It was inland about 120 miles.
Wow.
So, yeah, so well, so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help people get their heads around this idea of immense time. And so what happens is that I talk about this last glacial cycle that started 18,000 years ago. The glaciers were melting then, and they are melting now. But what some people don't know is this, these glaciers, interglacials, have happened at least 17 times in the last 2 million years. So not only is this not exciting, it's not unique. This idea of climate change is as old as the history of the Earth, and that's about 4.5 billion years. But what is 4.5 billion years in terms of a human life? What I will tell you is that if you stretch your arms out, if you stretch them out from side to side and you measured and you called that all of that of the existence of the Earth was the entire distance from your fingertip to fingertip.
Mm-hmm.
If you cut your fingernail off on one of the hands, you would have wiped out the last 2 million years of Earth history. And so what happens is, not only did this glacial-interglacial happen within the last, 17 times in the last 2 million years, but if you go to places like Pennsylvania, you know the big coal fields there?
Yeah.
Yeah, what happens is, the reason there's coal there is they have layers and layers and layers of coal. And part of the reason for the layers and layers of coal is that when the sea level was high, the coal was deposited. When the sea level was low, you had other materials being deposited. So you have these multiple layers of coal layers, 39 of them altogether. And coincidentally, those layers of coal were deposited in Pennsylvania exactly at the same time that another glacial, interglacial period was happening. Okay? So not only did this happen within the last 2 million years, but it also happened hundreds of millions of years ago. And if you go far enough back, and this is really stretching it, if you go far enough back to 2 billion years ago, they have iron ore deposits that were deposited. All the iron ore, well, not all the iron ore, but 90% of all the iron ore was deposited about 2 billion years ago. And what had happened was, 2 billion years ago, was that you finally got some photosynthetic plants that were able to produce oxygen. Once it produced oxygen, the iron within the earth was able to form iron oxide. And so now you have if you go to Minnesota, all the iron ore deposits, the big, big red hills that are around Minnesota, around Hibbing, and places like that, they were all formed about 2 billion years ago when the plants started converting photosynthesizing and taking the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And we're not talking part of a percent. We're talking most of the atmosphere was carbon dioxide. Once these plants started producing oxygen, right, taking up the carbon dioxide and producing oxygen, you had all these iron ore deposits. Now, the crazy thing about it is, so you have an atmosphere that it's not a part of a percent like we have today. We're talking about 85% to 95% of the atmosphere was actually carbon dioxide. Now, here's what the trouble
is. Hold
on.
I have. You still there?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what happened. Blog Talk overrode us for just a second, but go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, all I'm telling you is that one time in the Earth's history, when carbon dioxide made up, you know, somewhere around that 80% of the entire atmosphere, you still had glaciation, right? So the ice, maximum ice, was occurring almost exactly at the same time and that you had the bulk of the atmosphere was carbon dioxide. So for you to tell me that a change of 100 parts per million, and remember what 100 parts per million is, because they talk about it, you know, and when you're talking about hundreds, that's got to be a lot, right? But in this
right.
case, you're talking about 1/100th of 1%, okay? So what happens is we have a very, very small amount of carbon dioxide in the air, whether humans are there and whether humans are not there. And yet there are times back in the past history of the Earth where carbon dioxide made up the bulk of the atmosphere and you still had ice forming.
So we're talking levels that were several thousand times as high as what we have now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what we're
and
talking
yet ice
about...
Yet ice was able to form.
Yes, exactly. So what happens is that so you have the glaciers that are concurrent with huge amounts of carbon dioxide. Tens of thousands of times the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and you still have ice being formed. Now, how do we know these glaciers were here at the time? Well, this is what the big problem is that we have to show people. Now, if you look at, if anybody who's listening has ever tracked game, you know, if you've tracked a deer or you're a bird watcher or something, you know that every animal, you can determine a lot of times which direction the animal went and how long it's been since it's passed by. Since by what it leaves behind, by the tracks, by its droppings, there's a bunch of ways that you can tell, you know, the travel path of that animal. Now, here's what the thing is glaciers behave exactly the same way as an animal. They're born, they move forward, and then eventually they die. And you're able to tell exactly the same things about the glaciers as you are by the animals by what it leaves behind. Because some of the features that a glacier leaves behind is it leaves behind glacial till. And what that is just unconsolidated rock. Remember earlier in the show I told you that that New York was covered with glaciers at one time? How we know that is that Long Island and the island of Manhattan is full of glacial till. And so what that is, that's a whole bunch of different kinds of rock. It's all rounded, it's scratched up, but what it is, it's a definite sign that glacial till is present, and because the glacial till is present, that means the glaciers must be present. Now, if you've ever been to a glacier, and us people here in Alberta, we're fortunate to have one of the most accessible glaciers in the world in this beautiful province that I live in, and that glacier is Athabasca Glacier. And so if you go to a modern glacier and you have a look at it, you realize that nothing can grow on top of the glacier, right? Because there's no soil, it's too cold, it's all ice, and nothing can grow underneath the glacier because not only is it too cold and there's no soil, but you also have thousands of pounds of ice on top of it. So what happens is any plants or animals that exist must have happened after the glacier went, after the glacier receded. So what happens is, in New York, we're aware that the glaciers used to be there, and how we're able to tell how long ago they used to be there is that as soon as the glaciers backed off, plants and trees started growing there. And what we can do is we can use carbon-14 dating, which measures the difference between carbon-12, the ratio of carbon-12 and carbon-14 in the plant material, and we can determine how long ago that glacier was in New York. And because of the carbon-14 dating, we can say that the glaciers used to cover New York just about 17,000 years ago. Okay.
Now, you said that you could actually look at the skyline and tell specifically where the glaciers were, correct?
Absolutely. Now, one of the coolest things about New York City is that Manhattan, where Central Park is, you have a thing that's called Manhattan Schist, and that's a good solid rock for building buildings on. And so what happens is that as you go south on the Manhattan Schist, you get into progressively deeper and deeper amounts of till. Okay? So glacial till is terrible for building tall buildings on it. So as you go south, you have to dig your foundations deeper and deeper so that you can rest them on the Manhattan Schist, which is buried underneath the till. Eventually, you get to a place, and it's just a little bit, just past where the Empire State Building is that the till becomes too deep to build tall buildings on it. And so what happens is, if you look at the skyline, you go from tall buildings in Midtown to, as you proceed south, you get progressively smaller and smaller buildings. So if you look at the communities of Soho and Chinatown, they're all built on a material that can't hold up a matchstick. So as you go farther and farther south till you get to Wall Street and the financial areas, what happens is the till becomes shallower and shallower, and where the World Trade Center is, it becomes shallow enough that if you dig your foundations down, you can start building tall buildings again. So where the glacial till was, you can't build really tall buildings. Where the glacial till is thin, you can build the tall buildings. So what you have is between the Empire State Building and where the World Trade Center once stood, you have a deep pile of glacial till that's basically incompetent for building tall buildings.
That is interesting, and you know, as I sit here and listen to you describe this, I'm laughing inside at some of the remarks that you know, Ed Begley Jr. had made when he was debating Stuart Varney on Fox News, suggesting that in order to have an intelligent conversation about climate change, you have to talk to a true climatologist. You know, forget about the meteorologist, forget about the geologist. You only want to talk to climatologists. And as I sit here and listen to you as a geologist, I couldn't imagine anyone being in a better position to discuss the impact of climate change and the evidence left behind by climate change on planet Earth. I mean, it's been, you're the first geologist I've had on the air, and it's remarkable to hear you put the pieces together and sort of bring the picture together in a way that we can all understand.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting things is, as a consulting geologist, how I got onto this, because like I've won a numerous environmental awards, two from Environment Canada, and two from the Emerald Foundation of Alberta for environmental excellence. And so part of how I found out about this is one of my awards was for building an energy efficient home. And again, it wasn't technically, it didn't involve solar panels or geothermal. It didn't involve any of that. It involved using grade 9 physics. So I built this monster house, and to put it in context, this monster house is about 3,500 kilometers north of Al Gore's Bellmead Mansion, right? So this monster house is 5,500 square feet. And I'm in Canada. I mean, it gets cold here in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Al Gore's house uses 51 times more natural gas and 14 times as much electricity as my house does, right? And so when I built this in 2000, and I wrote a book, and I taught a course at the University of Alberta Extension on building an energy-efficient house for less. And in order to, you know, to sell the book and sell the course, I wanted to call this a Kyoto house, because you know, by multiplying large numbers together, I could prove that you could meet the Kyoto Accord without touching industry. Now, my trouble was, when I read the Kyoto Accord, the first thing I looked at was, this is fraud. This is absolutely intellectual fraud. Now, one of the things that they have in there is that, remember, it's all computer models, right? The predictions are always on the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Al Gore, in his movie, he says, in 100 years' time, the temperature, the sea level, and we can argue till the cows come home about what's going to happen. What we can't argue about is what is already happening. And that's where I work as a geologist, because I say, listen, this has already happened. You know what? We can't argue about this. But so anyway, I'm looking in this IPCC protocol, and I think they called it IPCC because it reminds me of the CPCC, the former Soviet Union. They wanted to have something so that we get the same impact. If we use a bunch of letters in a series, we can make this sound like a communist plot to overthrow the world. Anyway, the whole point is that I looked into this, and the first thing I look, and remember, I'm a consulting geologist. People hire me to say, are these guys lying or are they not lying? Are there minerals there? Are there oil and gas there? You know, what's happening? So people would hire me. And it's just like the four boys in a, you know, that were late for school. You put them all in a different room, and you say, oh, yeah, our tire blew out. That's why we're late for school. And then you put them in a different room, and you say, okay, which tire blew out, right? And so that's what you've got to do, is you've got to pick this apart. So when I was looking at this, they talk about, because it's not about greenhouse gases. It's about carbon dioxide. And so in your computer models, right?
Well, the biggest greenhouse gas contributor is water vapor, correct?
Right.
Absolutely. You can't tax that, though.
They left out water vapor. Water vapor accounts for 70 to 90% of all the climate change. And they say, we can't include that. And the reason they can't include that is there's no money in controlling water vapor. There is no money in controlling.
Exactly. You can't tax it.
So what I did is I had a closer look, and I said, they said, how long does carbon dioxide remain in the atmosphere? And if they have it in the report, you can read it, and it says carbon dioxide remains in the atmosphere someplace between 5 and 200 years. 5 and 200 years, that's a 40,000 percentage margin of error. Because here's what the trouble is that when you put, if you have a 40,000% margin of error, what can you make your computers predict? Anything you want. When you have a 40,000%.
Michael Mann proved that.
Absolutely. And so what happens is in the earlier reports, they were saying, we're going to have a 10-degree shift. We're going to have a 2-degree shift. It's going to get colder. It's going to get warmer. And all of those computer models were correct because you had garbage going in. So anyway, I looked at that and I said, that is just absolutely nuts. And then the other thing that I thought about was the computer models can only work forward, right? You cannot use the same computer models that they use to predict the future to give you an accurate representation of what happened in the past. If you understand what I'm saying? If you use
I do understand completely.
Yeah, because what happens is, if you say, yeah, this climate change is because human-induced carbon dioxide production, well, then how do you explain the previous 18,000 years using those same computer models? We know that Canada was completely covered in ice. We know much of the northern tier of the United States was covered in ice. But you can't explain that using their computer models. And so what happened is that I said, this is just insane. I think every time I think about that story, if they're doing it, why are they misleading people? And so the obvious reason is it's a money making scam. It's a money making scam. And the last big money making scam was, you know, where the guy went to jail, was Bernie Madoff. I mean, I think that's how he got his name. He made off with billions of dollars in investors' money, right? And there was a guy, his name was Harry Markopoulos, right? And he was telling the U.S. security regulators, for 10 years, Bernie's a fraud. Bernie's a fraud. And guess what they said? Who are you? You know, who are you? And so what happens is that, in my case, I feel like the same thing. For years, I've been saying, you fools. You know, it's physically impossible for us to have caused the previous, you know, deglacing cycle. And it's impossible for us to have caused the other 17 glacial, interglacial cycles, right? I said, will no one listen? And this is what's great when you're from a northern outpost in Canada, is that it's really easy not to listen to you. But what's really great is that I have this energy efficient house, because energy efficiency is one thing, but this entire house finished on three floors, 5,500 square feet, cost less than $35 per square foot to build.
Wow. Right?
Yeah, that's what the big thing was, is that I said this is the way to approach it. How I relate this is that, you know, people, when I speak at these functions, and I speak at many, many functions every year, and they introduce me as an environmentalist because I have this energy-efficient house. And I said, please, do not ever call me an environmentalist. I am a conservationist. And I will tell you right now the difference between a conservationist and an environmentalist. A conservationist, in order to save the environment, changes his own actions. An environmentalist, in order to save the environment, wants to change everybody else's actions except for their own. And if you use that definition, then Al Gore sincerely is one of the greatest environmentalists of all time. Because
Absolutely. What
he wants to do, he wants to change everybody else except for himself. Now, you may not believe this, but I don't have my own private Learjet to fly me from function to function.
Huh.
And I don't have a energy inefficient house where I can entertain friends, because you see what happens is the reason I do the things I do are partly for environmental concerns, but they're also partly for money conservation concerns. So when I'm talking I think even if I could afford a Learjet to go from place to place, I still think I would fly coach. But who knows?
Because we only have 90 seconds left live, and for the listeners that are listening live, Bruno, I'd like you to tell them how they can get your book and the special deal that you've put together for people who are listening to the show.
Oh, yeah, great. Now, what happens is that I have this book. It's called The Sky Is Not Falling. So you can either go to thesskyisnotfalling.ca, because I'm from Canada, so you can go to thesskyisfalling.ca. Normally the book is $19.95, and then it's shipping to the States. Well, it's Canada Post for you. But anyway, shipping to the States is around $6. So for the next week, anybody who orders the book, and it can either be for yourself or if you'd like to put it into a school, that would also be a great thing. We're waiving the shipping charges. So $19.95, you can either phone us or you can email us. There's an order form online. So it's thesskyisnotfalling.ca, or as an alternative, you can go to brunowiskel.com. So there's two ways you can get to it. And like I say, if you order it during this week, and this is not only for our friends in the United States, but it's also for Canadian, we're waiving the shipping charges, any place this goes.
Fantastic. We're going to go into some bonus footage, but for the live listeners, thanks for being with us. Okay, Bruno, we are officially off the air, but this is going to go into bonus footage, which means the people listening to the archive, and that's about 95% of the listeners, are going to be able to hear everything we're saying right now. I also want to state that I'm going to put something up on my website, which is thehootervillegazette.com, and I'll put something on the front page linking to your site. So for the listeners that are familiar with my site, I will put that up on my front page, and then so if they forget your web address, some of them are used to coming to my site, and they'll find their way there. Now, I'd like to, if you have a couple more minutes to stick with us, I'd like to ask you a couple more questions about the
book. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you pointed out, and I thought this was very accurate, is that almost all of the predictions that Al Gore makes are 100 years from now, and you pretty much suspect that his motive is he wants to make a prediction so far off in the future that everyone will be dead before he's proven wrong.
You're absolutely right about that. And that is, you know what, if you're going to make predictions, why don't you just make some predictions that can really help us, like in the stock market? Or, if you're going to do all these predictions with computer models, let's have at her. Don't just stop at the climate change. But the great thing about that is that, you know, like I alluded, this is absolute fraud. You know what, I think it's actually on your website, you say he's not evil, he's just wrong. And you know what, when you have a well-meaning person that really is trying to do something, you know, for somebody else or to help the earth, and they're wrong, you know, you can forgive them, right? But when you're mm-hmm. making hundreds of millions of dollars off this, this goes beyond wrong. This goes into evil, I'm afraid.
Let me explain that very quickly. What I have on my website is a link to Phelan McAleer and Ann McElhaney's movie site. The title of that movie is Not Evil, Just Wrong. And when I interviewed Phelan McAleer in Dallas, I guess it's been a year now, I asked him about the title because I had the same question that you do. And I said, Phelan, I said, I've been talking to you for an hour. I have to say, you seem to think that maybe not the foot soldiers, maybe not the people, the Greenpeace people at the bottom level, but certainly at the upper echelons of the environmental movement, that these people, including Al Gore, are evil. That's the take I'm getting from you right now. And what he said was is that there's a scene in the movie, Not Evil, Just Wrong, where they're interviewing Roy Innes, and I'm sure you're familiar with him as well. He's written a
Absolutely.
Great book regarding the impact of climate change legislation on black people. And in the movie, Roy Innes says these people need to understand, you know, they're not evil, but they're just wrong. So they took
right.
the title of the movie from that, but it is in no way reflective of Phelan or Ann's opinion about the upper echelons of the environmental movement, certainly not reflective of my opinion.
Yes.
And it's, again, so that's where that comes from.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you pointed that out because I said, geez, I'm going to be in some hot water here because that's evil. That, you know, and the sad thing about it is Bernie Madoff is going to spend the rest of his life in jail, right? And that's not sad. But the sad part is Al Gore is not going to see a single minute of jail time. You know, he's going to be able to, you know, he's going to be able to keep his Academy Award and his Nobel Prize and that truly
Grammy. He got a Grammy.
Oh, sorry,
for that
sorry.
Too.
Okay. Well, listen, he's got a bunch of awards. The
yeah.
sad thing about that is that he's going to go off into the sunset, and that truly is, you know, it just shows you where justice is. Anyway, you know, all of those guys, you know, one of the guys, and I'm not saying that they're all bad, but. You know, it started out with Nicholas Stern. I don't know if you know about him. He made a prediction. He's an economist, a British economist, and he said, "Oh, if we don't tackle global warming, the world economy is going to drop by like 13% or some made up number that really made it look bad, right?" And Nicholas Stern was it's not Nicholas Stern, it's Sir Nicholas Stern. And so he was, you know, the reason the Queen made him a knight was his ideas couldn't stand up to scrutiny in the light of day. That's what his problem is. And what they have found out that he's, you know, they reported because he had this, oh, this terrible catastrophe economically is going to happen if we don't tackle climate change. Turns out he was completely wrong, and he admitted he was wrong, but they did not change their report. It's just the same thing as the Himalayan glaciers receding. You know, they're going to be gone by 1938. You know, where did those numbers come from? You know,
no
the
idea.
Other thing is
I'd like
that
to know where, I'd like to know where Al Gore got the number that sea level is going to rise by 20 feet, because even the UN IPCC, which is itself prone to gross exaggeration, doesn't predict that. So no one's even asked him, hey, Al, where did you get the 20-foot number?
You know what, and I can tell you where he got the 20-foot number is. And I agree with Al Gore. You know, quote me on this one, all the listeners out there, quote me. Sea level will rise by 21 feet. I have no problem with that number. What Al Gore doesn't tell you, in his movie, he makes it look like it happened. Well, you saw the subways are flooding. Oh, my God. That's
sure,
terrible. We have
sure.
to go from boat to place, Manhattan Island, and won't be an island anymore. How sad is that? What Al doesn't tell you is where he got the 21 feet was 100,000 years ago when we were in the other interglacial, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sea level was 21 feet higher than it was today. Okay? So that's where he's getting the 21 feet from. And I honestly believe, because these things are cyclical in nature, I believe that sea level will rise 21 feet. The trouble is that Al didn't bother telling us is that it will take 6,000 years for us to get to that 21 feet. One of the things that happened, you know, they talk about the glaciers are receding at their fastest rate ever. And you know what? In human history, they may be receding quickly. But here's what the reality is. About 11,000 years ago, you have this ice front. This ice front that goes all the way from Alaska down to New York State. It's 5,000 miles long. The ice is a mile thick. And the reason I bring that up 11,000 years ago is that you have this glacial front that's, you know, just huge, with a huge thickness of ice. It was receding at just a little under a mile per year. No glacier in the world that's receding by just a little under a mile a year. And we're not talking about the massive ice. You know, the IPCC had a report where they said, you know, the sea level will rise somewhere between, you know, 1 centimeter and 10 centimeters of, and I believe that, because historically over the last 18,000 years, the sea level rise has risen somewhere between 1 centimeter and 10 centimeters per year, right?
Now, you quote in your book a time when it was 450 feet higher than it is today.
Right. You know what's great about this is that if you can extrapolate, you say, okay, the sea level is rising. Okay, let's go back 18,000 years, right? So what happens, what did the Earth look like when the sea level was, 450 feet lower? And so that exposes a whole lot of land. I told you earlier in the interview that New York City wasn't actually a coastal city. It was inland because mm-hmm. on the continental shelf where the slope is very, very small, for every time, the sea level goes down a foot, the shoreline moves out, 100 feet. Now, if you went to a place, I know you live in Florida and you probably never go to Hawaii.
I'm in Texas.
Oh, you're in Texas.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry, you're in Texas. So I don't know if you ever go to Hawaii. When the sea level was 420 feet lower than it was today,
okay.
You had a lower you had a lower choice of islands that you could go to.
Maui or what was it?
Yeah, it's called Maui Nui, and what happened was is that when the Hawaiian Islands are a series of overlapping volcanoes. And so what happens is, under the sea level, they join someplace. You can see that on the island of Maui, where you have two volcanoes, and there's a little kind of isthmus between them, and they're joined. If the sea level keeps rising, eventually that will be under, that'll be underwater, right? But there was a time when all that, there was a time when all those islands were connected. So Molokai, Lanai, Maui, and Kahoolawe, they were all connected. So you had one giant island, right? And then, of course, you had the big island, and then the other islands farther to the northeast. But what happened was these right on Maui, there's the lava from the West Maui volcano merged with the magma from the Haleakala volcano.
Hey, I'm looking at page 21 of your book, and I can't pronounce it either. So
yeah, anyway, so yeah, and I'm trying to do this all from memory. But the thing about this is that, yeah, what happens if the sea level rises? Those will form, you know, separate islands, right? And it's not a big deal. It's a, because there's nothing we can do to stop this, or at least historically speaking, and I'm talking historically the last 4.5 billion years, we have not been able to stop sea level rise. We have not been able to stop climate change. We have not been able to stop continental drift, volcanic activity, earthquake. You know, there's a number of geological processes that, despite of our intelligence, despite of the computer programs that we can develop and the nanotechnologies, there are some things that we are just going to have to accept that we can do nothing about. Now, when I say that, please, I am not trying to tell you that we cannot go out and pick up litter along the highway, that we cannot create an ideal situation for wildlife. In fact, what I do in the wintertime, because it's kind of cold here, I go from place to place in North America, because I don't know if our listeners are aware of this. I run a fruit and vegetable farm. We have the largest vineyard in Alberta. We're north of the U.S. border, 49th parallel anyway, about 600 miles. And we have a vineyard up here. Anyway, what I do is I go from place to place in North America talking to primarily farm groups, and I tell them how to integrate agricultural, water, and forest resources for the benefit of all three, right? So one of the cool things that I do is I have a logging operation, and that sounds really anti-environmental until you understand that none of the logs that I harvest are cut down by human hands. What I do is I use beavers to do the logging for me. Now, I'll tell you how I got into this great idea. Is if you're on the, you know, if you're in the West Coast in some of these logging areas, Oregon, Washington State, and you watch these the you know, forest companies go into the bush and they cut down trees, what they do is they cut down the trees, they take off the branches, and then they leave the branches in the bush, and then they take the log because they can saw it into lumber. If you look what the beavers do, what they do is they cut down the tree, they take the branches. The only thing that the beavers can't use is the log. And so what happens is, if I create a situation that is beneficial to the beavers, it's also beneficial to my logging operation because they do all the falling and delimbing work for me. All I have to do is go and remove the log from the forest. You can't guess.
Does PETA know about this?
I'll tell you what the trouble with is using beavers to do your logging for you. It is almost impossible to get those little webbed feet into steel-toed boots. Yeah, don't tell PETA that I'm not paying them. I just pay them wood chips.
That was my next question. What kind of benefits do they have? Are there stock options, retirement? That's fantastic. I'd love to be at one of your annual Christmas
parties. One of the things is, and this is what I do. If you fly over my property and you look at my property versus adjacent properties, properties on either side. Now, remember, beavers need flooring and water, so my property, has a creek going through it, right? It's not a river running through it, right? Because then I would have to do some crazy environmental stuff. But it's a creek running through it. Anyway, if you fly over our property in a small plane, you will see barren farmland on one side, barren farmland on the other side, oasis of trees, water, and animals in the center, and that's my place. And what happens is the reason I do that is because it's very important to show how we can integrate with the natural environment so everybody benefits. Now, that's what kind of conservation I'm talking about. But you see, if we dump money into fixing a problem that doesn't exist, it's going to result in billions of dollars, trillions of dollars of wasted money, and thousands of needlessly lost lives. Because what we're going to be doing is we're going to be focusing, we're concentrating on fixing something that we cannot fix, and ignoring the various and the myriad of activities where our little actions can actually help people out.
Yeah, I think Bjorn Lomborg makes the same point. I mean, we're ignoring immediate, less costly solutions now, and to chase temperature by a couple of degrees over 100 years.
And the trouble with that is, no matter how much money you dump into that, there's nothing that we can do that's going to change it. You see, one of the other things that I noticed was, and this just comes from an Environment Canada, because I was telling you how I was going to build this Kyoto house, and I no longer call it a Kyoto house because I would be buying into the fraud. You have to remember, I own a tree nursery here, and one of the reasons that I'm able to take my, I'm going to not call it a skeptic, climate skeptic, I'm going to call it a climate realist, I'm going to call it an anti-fraud squad. Part of the reason that I'm able to, speak to, talking on your radio show where everybody's kind of, believing in the same thing that we believe in is one thing, right? But my big challenge is to try and make the people who think Al Gore is the new messiah to say, listen, this is not quite true. And how I'm able to do that is that I own and operate a tree nursery. I have a garden center here. This is what I do for a living. And I tell those people right off the bat, because a lot of times I was in this one show that I was speaking to because they wanted to give balance, so there was 21 speakers that were talking about carbon trading, cap and trade, this and that, we got to do this. And then there was me. And I was speaking at this conference, and these guys, they already knew what I was going to say. They knew my exact words. And their arms were crossed, and their faces were puckered into a frown, and their butt cheeks were so tight they could have cracked walnuts.
Wow.
And what happened was I came
in.
I'm
not going to ask you how you proved that.
So what happened was, this was in the beautiful town of Banff, right in the Rocky Mountains, and they gave us some bear whistles, and I always try to lighten up the conference by having some fun, right? And I said, oh my God, I wore my bear whistle in, and I said, geez, I made a terrible mistake. Everybody here is wearing clothes, and anyway, nobody got the joke. And then on the back of the bear whistle, they have a little compass, right? I said, theoretically, if you get lost in Banff, which, I would just use my GPS. But anyway, they have this little compass on the back. And I said, the reason the conference organizers put this compass on the back is they realize you guys are all going in the wrong direction on this climate change issue, right? Well, that did not endear me to any of these. But what I did is I pointed out to them that in my forest where we do beaver logging, we take school groups, and we show what is possible, what one person can do to preserve the environment. I point out to them that I said, as the owner of a tree nursery, I will plant because we're in our planting season, I will plant in the next 6 weeks more trees than all of you guys and all of your families will plant in your lifetimes, right? And so when you start talking on those terms about, I'm not saying this because I work for an oil company or I work this, I'm saying I'm doing this. The reason I'm against fighting climate change is that I want to preserve the planet, right? I sincerely do. You know, I want to make this a better place for everyone and not grandkids. I'm talking about right now. And you see, if we dump money, if we argue, if we form committees on trying to change something that we can't change, then guess what? That means money that for things that we can change is being needlessly spent. Anyway, so what happens is when I go into these little groups, I always approach it from that tack, saying, if you think there's two sides and I'm on the other side, you are completely wrong. And then, of course, this talk where it was, they were so uptight to start off with, I actually finished the talk with a standing ovation.
Wow.
And the reason it is because we can argue about I mentioned it before and I will mention it again. We can argue till the cows come home. And I know that because I actually have cattle on my farm.
I've seen the pictures.
Yeah. So what happens is that we can argue till the cows come home about what's going to happen in the future. But when I show them the slide, the same movie that's in the book, when I show that on a PowerPoint presentation, a bunch of still slides in rapid succession where they can see 18,000 years of deglaciation in 30 seconds, they start to understand that it's not us that's causing that. And that's the most important thing. And once they can get their head around that this is just a natural process in a natural world, then it becomes really easy to accept everything else that I'm trying to, you know, that I'm trying to say about that. And then, of
in 99.5, if I could throw this out there for the listeners, if I got this from the book correctly, as we flip the pages and make that little movie happen, 99.5% of that deglaciation occurred before humans developed an appetite for fossil fuels.
Absolutely. So, you know, this whole idea of, you know, us changing things is just absolutely insane. You know, and again, just to make the point again, is that, you know, if a process has already happened and we can prove that it has happened, then we don't have to explain. It's called Occam's Razor, and it says multiple excuses should never be entertained. Usually, the simplest way of looking at a problem is just saying, what has happened in the past? There is a fellow, his name slips my mind, but he said, the present is the key to the past. And then as a corollary, the past is the key to the present. So what happened before is probably happening now. You know, to say that, you know, all of a sudden we have this, and we do, we have an enormous impact on certain aspects of our environment. But one of the biggest impacts that we don't have is, and I mentioned it, you know, volcanoes. Hey, let's, you know, if you're looking at how many people killed by climate change, let's look at how many people are killed by, you know, about mudslides, right? About every time there's an earthquake, as we saw in Haiti, as we saw in Chile. You know, the earthquake that caused the Boxing Day tsunami, you know, when those hundreds of thousands of people were killed. So, you know, how many people has climate change killed? Well, comparably, none. Right? So why don't we focus on stopping earthquakes, right? And the reason.
Well, hang on a second, because yeah. you know the latest line from the environmentalist, and that is that receding glaciers are taking pressure off the Earth's plates, and that is causing these earthquakes to take place. I know you've heard that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the cool things about that, and this is And this goes back to when I didn't know anything about the Kyoto Accord or IPC, and you know, really, my other books were here's how exciting they were. My previous three books before the climate change thing were Pond Raising Rainbow Trout, Woodlot Management, and Designing and Landscaping the Family Home, which is now called Building an Energy Efficient Home for Less.
My mom used to read me to sleep with that in Silent Spring.
Yeah, all these other books that I wrote, you know, always have the environmental side to it. But the idea, one of the things that just made me angry when I read the Kyoto Report was that so you have. It's going to cause more droughts and more floods, right? So, So what does that mean? Those are the two end members on a complete spectrum of what we call weather. So more droughts, more floods. So if climate change is causing more droughts and more floods, what's the implication? It's causing everything in between too, right?
Sure.
So it's causing more droughts, more floods. There's going to be more insects that are going to be destroying more crops. And then of course as you take the pressure off the earth, it's going to cause more earthquakes. And so what happens is I looked at that and I said, okay, here's what's happening: more disease, more pestilence, more destruction, you know, more flood. And I said, the last time that I read a document that a single entity was causing all these different disasters was the Bible, right? So, So there's two ways of looking at that. You see, if you're a Bible believer and you believe in a power greater than you is responsible for these, you know, physical actions, then what you're doing is that is the climate change is the biggest heresy in the world. Because all of a sudden we're taking it for something that God is doing to something that humans are doing, right? So we're taking the reins away from God, and we're saying, hey, listen, we can change it. This is not a natural phenomenon or a God phenomenon. This is, we're doing it, right? Mm-hmm. The other way of looking at it is that climate change is not a science. It's a religion, right? And so what you're doing
So Al Gore is the Pope,
right?
And James Hansen and Michael Mann are bishops or something?
Well, I don't know. You know what? One of the things about that,
didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, one of the things about that is that Because there is, I always put it to the context is, you know, are these guys doing it for humanity? Or are they doing it for money, property, and prestige? And if you look at the person who's in charge of the climate change for the IPCC is, and I can't pronounce his name. I can only say his last name is Pachauri.
Right? I think it's Rajendra Pachauri.
Rajendra Pachauri. And you say, wow, this is great. But when you look at that his you know, companies that he is either control of or has partial control of are making tens of millions of dollars per year, you know, based on the fraud. As long as the fraud, as long as the scam continues, he makes a pile of dough. That's why he yelled out, oh, voodoo science, right? And what was really sad about that, it was actually the IPCC that was providing voodoo science. Now, one of the things that the skeptics, and I'm not going to talk about the skeptics, but the alarmists are correct on, is that when you take away the ice, you know those memory foams? Do you know the memory foam?
I saw it in your book, yes.
If you have a bed on the memory foam, and what happens is if you lay on the memory foam, it conforms to your body. But once you get off, you know, you get out of bed, then guess what happens? It it rebounds back to its normal flat surface. So when you have a great deal of ice, and we're talking about miles of ice in this time, and so when you've got a mile of ice on top of the surface of the Earth, the rock, as crazy as it sounds, behaves plastically. So what happens is, just like that memory foam, you put the ice on top of the Earth's crust, and it'll push the Earth's crust down. You take the ice off of the Earth's crust, it rebounds. Now, what happens?
So, was Haiti indicative of that rebounding?
No. What I'm talking about is that there was never ice on Haiti. So, Haiti is where two plates converge. Right. This has nothing to do with ice. Remember, where the ice used to be, and here's where the ice used to be. It used to be in all of Canada and parts of the United States. England was partially covered. All the Scandinavian countries were covered. So what happens is wherever the ice was, and the ice is no longer, the rebound of the Earth, so where is it happening? Primarily in Canada and Scandinavia and parts of the of Russia, where the ice used to be. And so what happens is, as the ice is gone, the crust rebounds. So as the crust moves up, what does it push out of the way? The water, right? And what's cool about that is that as this crust rebounds and pushes the water out of the way, it actually contributes to the sea level rise. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying.
No, I do. In fact, I got
okay.
It when I read your book.
Okay, good. Yeah, because one of the things that I have, you know, all it is using scientific logic, right? So if this happens, if the ice presses the crust down, when you remove the ice comes back, the ground level comes back up, and as the ground level comes up, the water runs away from the rising ground. So what it does is it contributes to sea level rise. What I'm trying to tell you is that if none of the glaciers in the Antarctic, Greenland, or any other place were melting, the sea level would still be rising. And that's just complete because of glacial rebound.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Can I ask you,
the reason they don't include that, the reason that they don't include that as part of the sea level rise, the reason they don't point out to say, oh, by the way, sea level would be rising anyway, even if the glaciers weren't melting, is because it does not. They left it out. They are habitual in leaving out certain pertinent facts that do not support.
Like the little ice age in the medieval warm period?
Some of those things. The reason, remember I was telling you, I said we have the largest vineyard in Alberta. Part of the reason I planted that vineyard was in defiance. The reason that they knew that there was a medieval warm period is they went back to the tax records in Britain, and they realized that people were growing grapes in Britain where typically grapes do not grow, right? And then as you went out of the medieval warm period into the Little Ice Age, guess what happens? They could no longer successfully grow grapes there, so France is wine drinkers. Great Britain is beer drinkers, right? Because they could not grow grapes there. So out of defiance, and because I know that global warming is happening, and that would happen whether we were here or not, I said, I am going to plant myself my own vineyard, and I'm going to grow grapes to show people. You see, one of the things that happens is, and this comes from all of your listeners who like to, you know, play around in the garden, right? What we have is plant hardiness zones, and they go from 1 till 10. 1 is it's so freaking cold we can't grow anything, and 10, where are you in Texas?
I am in central Texas. I'm about 100 miles northwest of Houston.
Oh, northwest of Houston. Okay, so you still get some, did you get some snow there this year?
Some what?
Did you get some snow there this year? I know Dallas got some snow.
We did, in fact. We did, in fact.
Did
not
you?
Once, but twice. Not
oh,
once, but
twice.
Twice.
Wow. we got snow here only once, but it started in November and it went all the way to April. Anyway,
Just to give you a reference, I'm 47 years old. I've lived here all but 1 year of my life, and it's probably snowed a dozen times in that 47 years.
Absolutely. So where we are, it snows every winter. We get lots of snow. It's very cold, brutally cold sometimes in the winter. So what happens is we cannot grow, where you are, you can grow fruit and vegetable crops, you know, that can feed people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't, you know, we have a lower ability to do that because it just gets too cold in here. As the climate warms, the plant hardiness zones, we're in a zone 2, you're probably in a zone 9, because zone 10 means it never freezes. Zone 9 means it freezes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably can grow 1,500 different plants, trees, and shrubs there, where we can only grow about 150, because there's very few plants and trees that are capable of living in such a harsh climate. As the climate warms, these plant hardiness zones move north, which means places where you couldn't grow anything at all, you can grow something, and places that you could grow only wheat and barley to make beer, as they did in Britain, you can now grow grapes. So everybody talks about humans causing climate change. But what you realize is as the climate warms and the plant hardiness zones move north, you get a larger and larger agricultural area to support a larger and larger population. So as it gets warmer in Canada, as it gets warmer in the Soviet Union, more land can come under agricultural production. The more land that comes under agricultural production means you can support a larger population. So here's what I'm trying to say. Humans are not causing global warming. Global warming is causing humans, right? Because once the temperature starts cooling down, what happens? The same thing that happened in Britain is that you can grow less and less crops. And this is when you have, where you have the real famines is not years of especially hot. You have the real famines when you have years of unusually cold.
I think it was it Patrick Moore who said ice is the enemy of life?
Absolutely. And one of the things is these guys, it's so funny, they're trying to reverse climate change. You know, we're in Canada, for God's sakes. You know, we want to get colder? I don't think so, guys, right? We go down to Texas for holidays. Nobody comes up here in winter for the holidays. So, yeah, remember the only time that people were able to live in ice? Do you remember that time?
I do not.
It was in a movie. It was Luke Skywalker, and it was called The Revenge of something or other. I can't remember what it was. But that was the only time I've ever seen it in any movie where people were actually able to live within a glacier. But unfortunately, it was a fantasy movie. And that's exactly what the whole deal is. I'm just going to kind of go on here because I don't want to get away from this is a whole fraud. And I'm going to tell you a happy little story about fraud right here in our home province of Alberta. There's this environmental.
This isn't the Pembina group or whatever.
It is. Can I tell that story or are we not
Please.
Allowed to?
No, we've got plenty of time.
Okay,
and,
good. I love this story because it shows you. Listen, you know what? I tell you what, I'm a fruit and vegetable farmer here. You know what I mean? If I can figure out these things, anybody can figure out these things. Now, here's what happens. You're aware of the Alberta oil sands, the dirty oil from Alberta oil sands. Well, what happened is the Pembina group, they just, you know what? Every time they launch a protest, every time they shut down, you know, they send these activists. Remember, they don't want to change their own. There are true environmental groups. They don't want to change their own actions. They want to change everybody else's actions, right? So what they want to do is they say, oh, these guys, they're making so much money, and what we really want to do is we want to make a lot of money, right? And so here's the best way we can do this. So what they do is they hammer on these oil sands. They're the two biggest players, and now there's a whole bunch now, but the two biggest players were Syncrude and Suncor. And and they were producing just a whole whack of carbon, tons of carbon dioxide. And I'm saying, so what? You know what I mean? Because carbon dioxide is not, you know, it, for me, it's meaningless. You know what? So what? They're producing carbon dioxide. Every time I breathe out, Mark, I think you're the same way in Texas. Every time you breathe out, you're producing carbon dioxide. Okay?
Last time I checked, we do. And yep. I also, after this story, would like you to get into the benefits of carbon dioxide on plants. Go ahead.
Anyway, so what happens was these guys were saying, so they're hammering these oil science guys. And why am I concerned? Because I sell trees to the people who make this, you know, make large amount of money working in the oil sands. So anyway, they're hamming on, but they came up with some statistics, and the statistics were that Syncrude and Suncor, the two major oil sand producers, were producing a lot of carbon dioxide. But there was one.
Well, that's a name. I hate to interrupt, but Syncrude. I mean, that plays right into
that. It's short for synthetic crude, right?
Okay.
Because they change it from tar into flowable oil, so it's called synthetic crude. No.
Okay.
It's not about
okay.
sinning. It's not that kind of sin. But now that you mention it, that's very funny. So it's Syncrude and Suncor, and Suncor is Sunoco company of. I think it's California, but I could be wrong. Anyway, the point is they're producing lots of carbon dioxide. But if you added the carbon dioxide production of Syncrude and Suncor, it did not match if the combined total did not match the total amount of carbon dioxide produced by TransAlta utilities producing electricity from a coal-burning facility. Now, remember, I'm a geologist, so I'm used to people digging things out of the ground and then putting it back and planting trees on what's on the top. So if you go to Syncrude and Suncor, yes, they make a big hole. Yes, they extract hydrocarbons. Yes, they put it back to normal. But if you go to TransAlta Utilities, what they do is yes, they make a big hole. Yes, they extract the hydrocarbons. And yes, they put it back. They reclaim the land after. I'm not after any of the companies for their environmental practices. I don't have a problem with that at all. And I don't have a problem with Syncrude producing carbon dioxide. And I don't have a problem with TransAlta producing carbon dioxide. But what was funny about it was the Pembina Group, they were hammering the oil sands for producing too much carbon dioxide. And yet they were leaving TransAlta complete. I mean, they didn't say a peep to TransAlta Utilities. And here's
I can't imagine why that would be.
Now, remember, you're more familiar with this, and all I remember is Robert Redford in the movie, but think of Watergate, and they had a guy, his name was Deep Throat, and he said, follow the money,
uh-huh.
Right? So follow the money. So I just thought there's got to be a financial connection between TransAlta Utilities, even though they're producing double the carbon dioxide of either one of the two plants. I said, because you see, the oil sands plant are like 400 miles away, and the TransAlta plant is 30 miles away from the head offices of the Pembina Group. And I said, geez, they don't even have to jump in a car and drive anyplace and take pictures. Why aren't they not going? So that's the why. So the big thing was follow the money. And you know what? It's really easy here because, you know, Canadians are very honest people. And so I just phoned them up. I said, listen, I want to buy a wind-powered certificate off you, right? Because they were talking about how they raise money as they sell environmentally friendly wind-generated power, right? So I said, I will buy into this. I don't believe it, but I will buy into it so I can get some information. So here's what the information that I found out was. Is that there, the wind farm that they were selling environmental certificates for, right? They said they said in their advertisements, you buy an environmental certificate, and here's what we're going to do. You're going to be saving the planet because you're going to be reducing carbon dioxide. So what happened was I bought this wind certificate. Now, who is supplying?
Which is essentially a carbon offset.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. So what happens is I buy this certificate. They actually can't change the electrons that are coming to my house anyway. It's like I call it a guilt tax, right? Because, oh, yes, I'm using so much electricity and so much gas and so much. So I'm kind of guilty about that, as Al Gore is, because he doesn't want to change his lifestyle, because that would be, well, changing his lifestyle. So it's much easier and cheaper for him to buy carbon offsets, right? And what are carbon offsets? Now I'm getting things. So, anyway,
am I getting you worked up here?
Yeah, you are, because now I start talking about carbon offsets. I'm going to finish this story, and we'll talk about carbon offsets afterwards.
That's fine. Take your time.
Anyway, so what happened was, is I bought this wind-powered certificate, and so it's supposed to make me feel real good, even though it has no resale value. Pembina Institute actually takes off 50%. Imagine if you donated to the Red Cross and they said, listen, for every dollar that we're going to send to Haiti, we're actually going to take 50% off as administration fee. Would you donate to them or not?
No.
No, absolutely not. So what happens is this carbon certificate that's supposed to make me feel good for using electricity, it's a carbon offset, they're actually taking off 50% of the dough. Then guess what happens? So I find out, I said, so who's providing your wind power for these carbon certificates? It was a company called, and this is two phone calls. We're not talking about I had to break into something and I had to wiretap or I had to do anything. It was two phone calls. So I phoned Vision Quest Energy talking about their wind power. And you guys are producing wind power and you're selling these certificates. And are you profitable? Yes, we are profitable. And where do your profits go? Well, they go to our parent company. And who is their parent company?
Dun-da-da-da.
TransAlta
Utilities. Yeah.
TransAlta Utilities. So here's what happens. Here's what our carbon offset certificate was buying. Here's what our carbon offset. I'm buying a carbon offset certificate from the largest producer of carbon dioxide in Canada. Let me say that again. This carbon offset certificate was being sold to me via the Pembina Institute by the largest producer of carbon dioxide in Canada. That is like Attila the Hun selling orphan certificates to Mother Teresa. It's absolutely insane. So it doesn't get better, Mark. It gets worse. So I looked and I checked and I said, how environmentally friendly? Okay, so TransAlta, because Vision Quest is profitable, and don't forget, they would not be profitable. The guys who run the wind turbines, Vision Quest, Wind Electric, is profitable only because they sell carbon offset certificates. But they send the profits to TransAlta Utilities. And so what did TransAlta Utilities do with these the profits from the carbon offset certificates? They built another coal-fired electrical generating plant. Does that sound like fraud? Does that sound like that is just so misleading? Because, you see, it doesn't get better, Mark. It gets worse. So one of the wind farms is called the Summerview Wind Farm. And what happens is Pembina Institute, any time an animal is killed, they at any oil installation, they are the first mouthpiece out of the gate. What they didn't tell you, go to their website. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. They have a little girl dancing in the flowers in front of wind turbines. What they don't show is the myriad of animals that are killed by the wind farms operating. So, Syncrude.
I'm guessing mostly birds?
Mostly bats, actually.
Bats?
Mostly
okay.
Bats. Yeah, so what happened was is that there was a problem. Syncrude had a problem with their tailing ponds, and some ducks were killed. And it was a lot. And I'm not condoning this in the least. There was 500 ducks killed, and that is a travesty. They landed in these, something went wrong, and they landed in the pond and they were killed. And 500 ducks is a travesty, but that doesn't amount to, you know, 500 ducks in the whole scope of things is probably equal to the first 5 minutes after the season opens, September 1st on duck season, right? So these 500 ducks were killed, but this summer view, that was a one-time thing. 500 ducks were killed one time. What this wind farm was doing is they found out, they sent some biologists out to check on this wind farm. They were getting the number of bats being killed per day was as much as 187 bats per day. And they didn't mention any of the other birds, right? So I'm thinking there's probably adding birds to that. The Altamont Pass, the wind farm in California, you know, that everybody loves to. You shoot a golden eagle, you're in jail, $100,000 fine. You run a wind farm that knocks off 500 golden eagles a year, not a peep. And the reason
I have not heard that.
Oh, that's amazing. And you know why there's not a peep? Because it's killing all the songbirds too. No, they're killing all the songbirds too. You know, yeah, absolutely. So what's happening is that the guys that were, you know, that are just hammering everybody else, they didn't mention the amount of, you know, your wind certificate that you just bought for, you know, $25 that we're taking 50% off the top, and you get no real benefit for. Not only are we supplying money to build another carbon emitter, we're also knocking off a few bats on your behalf just in case you have some problems in your house. Now, what we're going to do is, and I got to get this out of my system for God's sakes, it's a carbon offset. So if you have a carbon offset, what Al is doing, this only works because somebody else said this works, right? I mean, when you look at the logic at it, it's just absolutely freaking insane. It's insane. Carbon trading is insane. So here's what the deal is that if you produce a lot of carbon dioxide, they say you can buy using Al Gore's trading company, so he can make a couple of bucks off the deal too. If you want to feel good, and if they put cap and trade in, it's going to be law, baby. And so what happens is that you can buy carbon certificates from people or companies that do not produce carbon dioxide. So they're saying, hey, I'm not producing carbon dioxide, so we can sell you carbon offsets. Now think of this: how did the United States become the greatest country in the world? You know,
by having low cost energy at its disposal during critical times in its growth.
No, that's not what I'm getting at. What happens is the United States produced, they used innovation to produce different products. So if you were a widget company, you know, you would be able to say, listen, we produce widgets at a certain price for a certain quantity, right? And you would be able to look at those widgets and you'd say, wow, this is great. It has all the features I want, everything I want, right? So you compare it to other places. Sometimes places are low cost, but you say the quality isn't there. So what happens is in a competitive environment, which the United States was built on, is being outcompeting other countries, is that you're saying we produce a better product for a lower cost. Perfect. What's carbon trading doing? This is the first time people get paid for not producing something. So how can you compare what you're not producing at one place with you're not producing at the other place? Now think of it this way. When you breathe out, can you see your breath?
If it's cold enough.
Yeah, if it's cold enough, you see the water vapor, right?
Okay.
You see the water vapor. Carbon dioxide is tasteless, odorless, and colorless, right? So you can't see it. So not only can't you compare what you're not producing from one place to the other, but you can't even tell if the guy's not producing it or not. It's just getting crazy, right? Think of it. Now, I've got this business. I've got 7 employees or something like that, and I produce a reasonable amount of carbon dioxide. Now, who doesn't produce carbon dioxide? Think of all the people who don't produce carbon dioxide. Well, there's dead people, right? Well, who produce
right.
a lot? Street people, right?
By the way, in the States, we call those people who vote in Chicago.
Oh, okay. The people who produce are the street people, right? They don't have a car. They don't have a home. And they recycle their food from the trash bins. They are the low cost. So that means in a true carbon trading scheme, we would pay the street people money for not being productive.
So you're saying I'm going to go up to a street guy and say, hey, Schmitty, I'm over my limit. Can you hook a brother up?
That's exactly what I'm trying to tell you.
Wow.
Yeah. So what happens? Now think of it this way. I don't know if you have do you have children or not?
I have one son, but he's grown.
Okay. Now, did you encourage your son to be a street person so that he would produce less carbon dioxide? Or did you say, listen, can you be productive? Can you actually produce something that you can get paid for?
From the time he was 6 years old, I put him out on a street corner with one of those will work for food signs. No,
yes.
Of course. I mean, I sent him to, yeah.
Okay, so here I'm going to put it the other way. Okay, so Al Gore is carbon neutral. His house produces 51 times more natural gas than mine does, and 14 times more electricity. Now, that's great, but Al has the money. He's worth $100 million now, according to reports, so he can buy some carbon offset certificates from the Pembina Institute, right? And even though they're being produced by the largest producer of carbon dioxide in Canada, that's meaningless. The point is it's a thought that counts, right? So he's carbon neutral. So he's producing a lot.
Well, the only correction, I do have a quick correction. Al Gore prefers buying carbon offsets from himself.
Oh, right, because it's cheaper that way.
Yeah.
So let's put this into a different context so that we can. Now, what if I told you, instead of being carbon neutral, I'm spousal abuse neutral.
So if I want to take a swing at the wife, I have to buy an offset from you?
Right. No, I treat my wife really good, so I can sell.
I do too.
So I'm spousal abuse neutral.
Now, she may need to buy one from you to hit me after saying that. But
yeah. No. So what I'm – okay, let's put it to a different thing. And again, you see the insanity of it? The only way that, for some reason, that people believe that carbon offset works is because people say, oh, this is how, you know, you can save the planet by buying carbon offsets, right?
But give the example about the fat people. Give the example about the fat people. That's my favorite one.
Okay, yeah. So it's the same thing as instead of a carbon offset, let's have a calorie offset. So obese people, instead of dieting or exercising, they can be thin by buying calorie offsets from, say, the U.S. Olympic team, because those guys really exercise a lot. So what changes? See, nothing changes. The people who exercise still exercise, and the obese people still stay obese. Right? Nothing changes, but money changes hands for nothing being accomplished. Carbon trading is exactly the same way. All they're doing is money changes hands for nothing produced. And because of the nothing produced, you can't tell if it's being produced or not because it's colorless, tasteless, and odorless. You know, how great is that?
It's great if you can get in on it, I suppose.
Al Gore. Yeah, see, because I run a tree nursery. I mean, it would have been way easier for me to say, listen, if you buy a tree off me, because trees use up carbon dioxide, right? Because the photosynthetic reaction is you take a couple of carbon dioxide, take a couple of molecules of water into the tank, you combine them together under the presence of light, and what do you have? You have carbohydrate, you get oxygen, and water vapor as a byproduct of photosynthesis, right? So me selling trees, I could easily justify selling carbon credits.